here we are outside of Hello. It's just about 5:30. I wonder where folks are. No doubt the cold and wet weather is depressing attendance somewhat. The microphone here is still the wrong microphone, even though I went to the museum to switch it. I think I switched it back as well. Exceptionally busy today. All the students are moving out. I see David Green. And he's coming. He's jumping into Panera. Hey, Rachel. Great. I'm broadcasting right now. It's supposed to get cold.
What?
It's supposed to be cold.
It is kind of cold.
Like 40 tonight.
Is it?
In the 40s. Yeah, it is kind of cold now. Sure. Let's wait till people actually come, though. You have to flip the front part. That twists. No, the whole body twists. Well, you can take that the camera cap off, but yeah, what you do at the top. Just don't worry about it. It's set to basic. There's hundreds of photos on the card. Well, Tom Ginsberg, who's a law professor, said he'd come. David Green said he'd come. Sarah Lazare said he'd come. Adam said he couldn't come. Rosemary wants to come. Another guy said he wanted to come, but couldn't. He's out of town. Hi, are you Tom?
Yeah.
Hi.
Nice to meet you.
You look like Zoe.
You are?
Search for me. You also find somebody who's like my alter ego. She's like a professional activist. Yeah, it's really funny. And she lives in California. I grew up in California. Los Angeles. So it's as if I never left. Yeah. Yes. the public stare.
What's the program?
The program?
Yeah.
Well, the thing that I usually do, which I wasn't able to do today, is print out the invitation that I sort of sent out to people that I can sort of summarize, and then everyone who came sort of goes around and says what their initial thoughts or areas of concern, interest are, and then usually the conversation sort of takes off, and people have more interesting things to say than I could ever have imagined.
You feel familiar doing this?
No.
You didn't?
No. Uh-huh. We can, if they get pissed off, we can move on to the sidewalk.
Or sit on the grass.
Yeah. I have a blanket in the car. The plan was to sit on the grass. I don't want to block anyone's entrance to any buildings, but...
The other one's Friday
night. Yeah. Definitely didn't want to do that. So I do have a blanket in the car if people are willing to brave the damp on the grass. Yeah. Do you two know each other? Thought I swapped it for the mic in the museum, but I think I accidentally swapped it back. No matter what I say, levels, you have to talk like this into it. Yeah, that's what we'll do. That's what I have been doing. Well, personally, I invited about 7 or 8, and then I have a list of about 80, who I send out daily. I don't send them to the piece. I send the weeklies to the piece. I send out daily invitations for about 80 people, but usually we only have about 4 to 6, which is a good conversation size. We had a couple of things with more than that, and it's much more difficult to actually have a conversation with 25 people. It's much more like a seminar. But there were 3 other people who said that they were definitely coming who are not here yet. So we can wait a few more minutes.
No, I don't.
Rosemary said she'd come. Bob Naiman said he'd come. Sarah Lazare said she'd come. So those are the three. Sarah Lazare, she's an undergrad. But it's not unheard of that folks don't come if they say they'd come. Rosemary actually emailed me today saying, are we going to still do it if it's raining? Well, in the interest of time, let's start, even though all these people, I don't know. I know it's after 5:30, it's like probably 5:40. Yeah. So, it's a good 5-10 minutes after the fact. Because we're so small, such a small number of people, I'll be...
We need the mic.
We do actually, because I'm recording it and broadcasting it over there. There's a micro power transmitter in the car.
Okay. Where are you broadcasting?
Really? Around.
Yeah, you know, I can't do this. I'm sorry. I really can't. This is just, I'm totally supportive on the subject.
Mm-hmm. Where would you, would there be a place where we could sit rather that would?
Lot or something.
Okay.
I wouldn't mind talking there, but it's easy. But it's also, you know, just more of a, I don't know. Sort of what's the purpose here? What's the purpose to
Well, the purpose of the conversation is just to try to use a sort of a public square, a public space, for rather than just passing by, passing through, to actually activate it for a space of conversation. And that, in my mind, is something that can happen with a small number of people, a large number of people, whatever. But to try to have the content and the space to somehow relate to one another. So that was one of the reasons why I wanted to have it here. But if you could feel more comfortable going to the quad, we can do that.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. It looked like it was a pretty light tap.
I don't know. I'd be perfectly comfortable talking here. I wouldn't be comfortable broadcasting.
Okay.
So, and by the way, I think it's important to concern that I'm raising that. It's too often that I think progressives kind of step away from the institutions that we need to.
Mm-hmm.
People will all agree, mm-hmm. and that's really yeah. bad. And so I think it's really important to work for you.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
well, where should we move to? Yeah, we could go across the street.
Yeah, we can sit here and talk. I don't mind. I don't want to block that.
Well, I can shut down that yeah. part of it. And would you mind recording it?
Sure, I'm happy to call. Yes.
Okay. Pardon?
Sure.
Okay. Well, I can put down the transmitter.
I mean, you guys go ahead. I don't want to stop your phone. You know, and if you feel I'm being overly sensitive, you should call off.
It's part of her project. Broadcast it.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
What's the project?
She's it's a conceptual art piece, and it's. She's broadcasting these conversations on a pirate radio station, and then she's also broadcasting, I think, what's the sounds that are coming out of the MFA final exhibit.
You're taking too long with what? Yeah, let's get started. I saw one more person who's coming, but I think he has to put money in his meter. What? Carl. All right. This is a funny place. The noise keeps coming through the microphone, the loudspeaker telling people when their orders are ready. So that'll sound interesting. Just a note about technical stuff. The microphone is still not sensitive. It hasn't been fixing itself. I tried to fix it, but you have to hold it relatively close to your face these days for the sound to pick up in the recording. Thanks for coming. I'm Sarah. I'm the person who's organizing this conversation as a series of several to happen in a variety of public spaces around town, various other events as well, about claiming public space as a location for public discourse. These events are intentionally outdoors. Almost all of them have been outdoors, in order to take our culture outside and out of private spaces. This conversation is about Jewish American critics of Israel and the relationship between Jewish American critics of Israel and the what is seen as an almost monolithic Jewish American community, as well as the relation between those critics and sort of non-Jewish critics. I want everyone to go around and introduce themselves, but since I have the microphone, might as well introduce myself first. I'm not Jewish. It's interesting that the two conversations about vaguely around the subject of religious faith were both religions that I don't identify with, Christianity or Judaism. I grew up in a heavily Jewish neighborhood in Los Angeles during the 1980s. There were several synagogues in my area, one of which was firebombed when I was about 9 years old, and a few years later, when it reopened, it had sort of become the bunker. It had underground parking and a 12-foot wall around it, and there was a very, very much of a sense of a need to maintain security because of a very real thing that had happened. So that was the environment that I sort of grew up in, like very aware of the reality of anti-Semitism. There was another instance that synagogue had pig's blood splattered all over it. And as time has progressed from the mid-80s to the present, I found myself a couple of weeks ago, a month and a half ago or so, at the doctor's office with a nurse practitioner who said he was going to do a cycle tour for the Champaign-Urbana Jewish Federation. And I immediately felt myself caught, as if I was almost stealing for a possibility of a confrontation around the subject of the occupation. And I immediately then felt a terrible sense of shame, like I can't make that assumption that just because somebody's Jewish, they're supportive of the occupation. And then putting that experience into context with this sort of growing up with many Jewish people being aware of anti-Semitism and then feeling like my sentiments against the occupation were so strong that I started to make racist assumptions about people was very disturbing to me. And that's the motivation, and that's where this conversation is coming out of. So.
I'm David Green, and like Sarah, I also grew up in Los Angeles, something I didn't know about you, and now you probably didn't know about me. And I also grew up in a heavily Jewish neighborhood in Los Angeles, although I have a feeling a somewhat different one than what you grew up in, or at least I spent my teenage years there. And that included the 1967 war, and that was kind of the peak, I guess, of pride for most Jews in Israel, and something which I certainly shared in at that time. And I continued to share in that through my visit to Israel in 1974, which was subsequent to the Yom Kippur War, where I spent 6 months living on a kibbutz. And it really wasn't until, you know, fast forwarding quite a bit, it really wasn't until the late 90s, after sort of re-entering Jewish life in terms of raising a child and belonging to synagogues for the first time since I'd been a child, it wasn't until the 1990s and mid to late 1990s that I really started to think seriously again about Israel in the context of foreign affairs and especially U.S. foreign policy. And so since then, it's been a matter of sort of relocating myself in terms of my political views in general and my views about Israel in particular, and at the same time relocating myself within the Jewish community in terms of how do I relate to other people about this issue, and how can I perhaps even be a change agent within the Jewish community regarding Israel and the whole issue of Zionism, the Jewish state, and the Palestinian rights. And I'll say more about that later, perhaps. But that's enough now.
I'll talk a little further. I'm Tom Ginsberg. I'm Zoe's dad. Teaching the law school, and I follow these issues very closely, professionally and personally. I'm a fairly observant Jewish person who has both religious and political problems with the extent to which the religion has become the sort of glorification of a state, which is really just a modern political form. And just as I was saying earlier, I think it's very... You're going down,
sorry,
man. They follow you everywhere.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think it's very important to take this conversation into the Jewish community. You know, it really has to be done. And there's a lot of latent forces out there. We need not accept the kind of what I call a Stalinist structure of political views on this issue. So.
I'm Zoe. I'm kind of just an observer, so maybe I'll talk more later, but I'm going to introduce myself. I'm Zoe Ginsberg, his daughter.
Hi, I'm Sarah, and my dad's side of the family is Jewish, and my mom's isn't. The question of Israel is an extremely contentious issue on my dad's side of the family, as everyone is really, really politically involved, and my I told that side of the family that when I graduate from school here at U of I, I want to go to Palestine and do justice work. And my grandmother freaked out and told me that if I go to Palestine, I'm gonna die, and if I don't, she'll kill me, and all this stuff. And it was a really big deal. But not who writes a lot of stuff. Is anti-Zionist, and same with my dad, up witnessing that split, and actually, yeah. I think you can actually add yourself. I have a friend who added himself. Yeah.
All you have to do is be an obscure Jew in some local town by the time.
Yeah. Oh, no, that's fine. Yeah, so this is an issue that's really close to my heart. And it should be close to a lot of people's hearts, because our government is heavily involved in what's going on over there. So, I guess that's all I'm going to say for right now.
Are you a student here? Or?
Yeah, I'm an undergrad majoring in history, philosophy, and pre-med.
Pre-med?
Yeah.
Okay.
My name is Rachel. I'm a graduate student in the history department here at the U of I. I am originally from the Bronx, grew up in a non-observant Jewish family, but attended an Orthodox Jewish day school between three-year nursery and eighth grade. And did not even question whether the Chalutzim, the original Jewish pioneers, quote unquote, made the desert bloom until I was well into high school, late in high school. It was just like this was, you know, part of the air I breathed. I am now, I'm in my second year of graduate work, and it looks like my dissertation is going to be on something having to do with Zionism as colonialism. I just wrote a paper for my advisor that she liked, about, which is very exciting to me, about the dual nature of Anglo-Jewish identity in England, obviously, between 1871 and 1895, before Theodor Herzl emerges on the scene, and there's this idea of agitation for a Jewish state. There were Jewish colonies who worked with and sometimes against the Ottoman Empire, which of course was the ruling power in Palestine before World War I. So my basic argument was that the only way to really to express this completely dual identity of being both English and Jewish was both to support the Eastern European Jews who were the victims of pogroms and other anti-Semitic acts. So there's this idea of a pan-Jewish identity, responsibility for taking care of your own. But then this English identity, which is very dependent on support for and loyalty to the British Empire. And so the way to express this dual identity in one place was to colonize Palestine. So I'm very committed in my work to, I mean, even though I'm a historian, it's very much informed by the current political situation. And I think some people say it's a pipe dream that there will be peace in our time in the Middle East, but I'm a firm believer that it is a possibility. And part of the way to achieve that is to come to a reconciliation with the colonial past. So that's sort of where I'm coming from.
Does anyone have any thoughts for how to start?
I have all kinds of thoughts. Yeah. I'm never short on thoughts. But
I think the question that I had going into this conversation, this is probably the loudest place that we've...
The truck is finally leaving.
One of the thoughts that I had coming into this conversation and hearing everyone talk is the degree to which identity and personal history and history are all very deeply interwoven when considering these kinds of questions, and also how questions of identity sometimes allied questions of history, that you don't need to ask questions of history when there's this really strong sense of identification. And I'm curious to hear people's thoughts about that, or use that as a jumping off point in the conversation.
Well, I was just going to say the way the history is narrated is obviously really important. And I guess a really profound influence on me was reading the books of these revisionist Israeli historians, Benny Morris and such, and who now is politically incorrect for many on the left, but nevertheless has done a lot of great work. And, history causes you to question your identity, the unassumed positions that you have. So I think it's really important what you're doing, actually, to do the work of history and historiography.
I think that, I mean, it's an interesting question and a real fastball. The identity that I think the interesting part of it to me is reconciling our Jewish, sort of an assumed Jewish identity as being concerned with issues of social justice versus Zionism, and growing up being a little older in the 50s and 60s, those two things were in no way seen as separate. I mean, you couldn't really conceive that growing up in the 50s especially, and the 60s and into the 70s, you couldn't conceive that there was a radical disruption between social justice issues and Zionist issues, even though, I mean, I never was identified as a Zionist per se, that I never could conceive that Israel, that the whole issue of Israel in the Middle East was somehow in conflict with other issues of social justice, either within the United States or at a global level. Now, this came to be apparent, you know, I was a little young and I wasn't really that aware of the discourse that was going on, but this certainly came to be apparent to a lot of people after the 67 war, or even earlier in the civil rights movement in this country, as blacks in this country who were allied with Jews in the civil rights movement also started to conflict with Jews over not only issues of northern civil rights, but also global issues of civil rights in third world countries. So this whole identity of the identity of being a Jew and being aligned with issues of social justice and implications of socialism and so forth really began to create a lot of conflict in the 1960s and 70s. And personally, for me, these sort of submerged conflicts sort of maintain a, you know, a sort of, you know, a separate piece, as it were, through the 1970s and 1980s, and perhaps even seemed vindicated when Oslo came about in 1993. But it was soon after then that fell apart. It began to be clear to those who were perhaps more you know, attentive to it that wasn't going to work. And then I think that's the time when a lot of Jews, I think there was an upsurge there, and what I was dealing with at that time was, I think, what a lot of people were dealing with, that things weren't working properly, and something, it wasn't being understood properly, and what Tom said about looking at the history, and what Rachel has been doing. And at that time, and it also needs to be added that the historical sources, even though there was a lot out there going back to the 1970s, the historical sources that Tom was referring to weren't really more popularly available until the late 1980s. And so that all coincided in the 1990s in terms of a lot of Jews really examining the history and conflicts within Jewish identity between social justice and support for Israel.
Do you think that was a change that happened, or it was a coming to consciousness of a split that had always been there?
Well, I would answer that basically yes. I mean, I would say it was a submerged, repressed split. That was, I mean, I wouldn't necessarily want to put it in Freudian or Jungian terms, but it definitely was something that was there, that was sort of pushed down. I mean, within me, I think it was pushed down for a long time as I sort of dealt with other political and social justice issues. But I would say that the whole Israel issue was kind of the last major issue that I dealt with. I mean, after I dealt with Southeast Asia, Central America, I mean, all kinds of other things. I mean, it wasn't until all that I dealt with the Middle East, and especially the U.S. role in the Middle East.
I mean, the Intifada you didn't mention either, but that's obviously part of the timing, because, you know, if you have this perception that you're supposed to be the good guys and all of a sudden you see these images, then, and I think that's, in some ways, it's gotten a lot more complicated in the 1990s because the situation is a lot more, I mean, it's just a lot, it's easier to make morally ambiguous. It is more morally ambiguous than it was in the late 1980s, where it's, you know, kids with rocks against tanks all the time. That's all that was going on. And, you know, it's obviously a shame that the solution, which everyone knows what it is, it could be implemented tomorrow with the right political pressure from the United States, you know, just was, and obviously the right configuration of political forces in the region, didn't happen. And that's a sense of, I think, a great sense of frustration, at least I think many of us on the left have, you know, that so close and yet it didn't happen. And so within the community, the right is empowered. The people say, I told you so. They've always hated you. They always will hate you. And it's a real tragedy in the Greek sense.
Before we got started, you were talking a little bit about the necessity for people on the left in this issue, because I think it's important not to make this monolithic claim that, you know, someone's supportive of Israel then they're marching lockstep with some sort of right-wing agenda. Need to be part of the community, need to be part of mainstream Jewish organizations, and that's something that you have done, and I was wondering what your experience has been or how you've strategized around that involvement, if you're willing to answer the question.
It's been okay, but just, yeah. You know, I'm arguing with people all the time. It's a lot of fun, you know? Lawyers like to do that, so it's okay. What's the old expression, two Jews, three opinions, or something like that? That's what it's like, it's constant. But it's all right, you know? It's occasionally you get people who are sort of nuts, who are, you know, I mean, you get into real conflict, but you believe in your position, you can hold the line. So I just think it's so important. It really is. Too many people just leave it alone. and it reflects the fact that what has Judaism become in the United States? It's basically talking about the Holocaust and blind support of the state. And that's really bad, but that's what it's become. And I think it's important for those of us on the left not to let it become the reverse, which is that all it is opposition to the state, right? That there has to be something more to it than that. Or you have accepted implicitly the terms which are set out for you, that the state is equated to religion. And that can't be. We have to resist that. I don't know. I mean, there's obviously lots of different ways to be Jewish. You can be religious, you can, I don't know, cultural stuff. There's lots of different organizations. There's 50 or 100 progressive Jewish organizations that are working on this issue to get involved in. There's just lots of ways to do it. I'm certainly not going to dictate, even list a menu. I don't even know what the menu would be, but, there is, varied as there are Jews, I think, ways to go about it. So, but obviously get involved and get educated, read and join like-minded people and stay in the mainstream organizations. Don't cede that territory. Can't be done.
The issue of mainstream organizations is one that is near and dear to my heart. As an undergrad, not here, Bryn Mawr College, which you may have heard of, I was the president for a couple years of the Jewish Feminist Discussion Group, which was very, when it was founded before my time, was a very anti-Hillel organization. And I don't actually know the politics around why it was so anti-Hillel, but I inherited this institutional memory of we don't like Hillel without knowing why, and which is sort of interesting when you think about it. And we very much operated outside of Hillel in the bi-college community, Bryn Mawr, Haverford. And there was always an overlap between members of my group, which was very small. I think we had no more than 15 people on the email list at any one time, and of course, like this, a good conversation was usually 8 people at dinner, which is when we met. But I myself I sort of inherited this, and in retrospect, I'm not entirely sure why I was so opposed to Hillel, but I was very opposed to Hillel. And then when I came here, I've been to a couple of events at Hillel because, coming from the East Coast, I'm very used to being around a lot of Jews, and then I get here and there don't seem to be a lot of us. So I thought, I need to find my people. There's Hillel. And I feel very uncomfortable at Hillel as someone who didn't go to Camp Ramon, Wisconsin, is one issue, but also that I am. So my first weekend here, I went to a barbecue and an undergrad came up to me and she said, "Oh, are you interested in joining our organization? We educate the campus about Israel." And I looked at her and said, "I don't think I'm who you want, because I kind of think Ariel Sharon is a war criminal." And the thing is that she looked at me with this open mouth. She could not conceive of being a Jew and thinking Ariel Sharon was a war criminal. And I don't feel comfortable in a lot of organized Jewish spaces, but that also has to do with, my deep-seated feminism comes from growing up in an Orthodox community. Being told to sit behind a mechitza, a wall, and that I have to wear skirts and that I'm not allowed to chant the Torah. I don't see how you could not be a feminist in that sort of environment. So my discomfort with organized Judaism has a long history, and this is just it's another reason at this point in my life to feel uncomfortable with it. To me, being Jewish doesn't have to be keeping kosher or keeping Shabbat or, any other religious manifestation, but it is very important to me to be a member of a community, and that is very difficult. When I think about organizations, I can't think of one that is critical of Israel. And so I find myself, talking to other people like Rosemary, who's not here, or Adam, who is not here. I have personal acquaintances who are also Jewish and also critical of Israel, but there doesn't seem to be an umbrella. There doesn't seem to be an organization. Where's our minion? And See, but I don't, I guess that I feel. I guess I feel that I can't even go to Hillel and ask for anything. Because there's always, I'm on the email list and I'm always getting emails about going on, oh, what is the name? The trips, which are the free trips you can go on. And I'm always. No, it's called something else. It's totally slipping my mind at the moment. But it's Birthright.
Yeah, that's it.
Birthright, which in and of itself is such a.
That's the anti-abortion organization as well.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, there's an anti-abortion organization called Birthright.
Oh, that's fascinating.
That does a sign saying, you know, pregnant need help, and then they do anti-abortion.
There's also a group called Rachel Something too, which I, you know, which in Boston I think, which does that too. Yeah. So I find that amusing too. But I. Yeah.
Yeah, I think the question of like where to do anti-Zionist organizing is a really salient one. At my old university, for the first 2 years in Boulder, Colorado, which was really nice, we were really involved in anti-Zionist organizing, and there are some people that took the sort of like mainstream, you know, who like actually tried to organize like within Hillel and stuff like that, like some of my more progressive Jewish friends, and then there were others who sought a more like radical approach, like look, you know, like Zionism is okay, and it's not an element that's okay to have in a group, like you know, like it's deeply rooted in, you know, in racism and colonialism, and it's just like really not okay. It's not something that you overlook or like or work around, you know the same way that you know, sexism isn't okay and racism isn't okay, and I remember my good friend Nora took the more like talking to Hillel approach, and she told me the story about how she actually got really involved in that group, and she told me the story about how they were planning this event, and they were like going, everyone was like talking about how they love Israel so much, and Nora, they were like, so Nora, you know, how do you feel about Israel? And she was like, oh, I don't support Israel. And she said that someone just went, oh my God. And then there was just total silence. And she said that, like, at that moment, she just felt so uncomfortable and so silenced that, you know, and, like, this is a conversation that we had a lot because, you know, the question is, I, there's a little give and take. There's the radical, like look, I'm going to completely reject Zionism, like that's not, you know, if that's a part of your organization, I don't want to be a part of it. But then there's also the issue of like, how do you, you know, speak to the most people? And I found with anti-Zionist action organizing, what was for me what was most rewarding, and I think probably allowed me to offer the most of what I had to offer, was organizing with like Palestinian justice groups, which happened to be in Colorado, happened to be largely Arab, and sort of like offering, you know what I could as a resource for people that were doing that organizing, and I sort of found that I found that it was more effective to work with groups that already had an anti-Israel stance.
It's interesting to me that you bring up anti-Zionist activism, because something else I started researching this semester was you may be familiar with the report that was leaked at the very end of last year in December by the European Union Monitoring Center on Xenophobia and Racism and Xenophobia, which linked a rise in anti-Semitism, especially in France with all the synagogue burnings in 2002, to So there was this rise in anti-Semitism, but the perpetrators tended to be young Muslim men. So it wasn't, the conclusion of this report was not that this was a new rise of anti-Semitism in Europe, but that it was an imported anti-Semitism, and it was a Muslim anti-Semitism. And what it really is, and so that the point is that anti-Zionist activists use anti-Semitic tactics and rhetoric to make their point. And to me, that is the problem with aligning with certain, I'm not saying that the group that you were organized with, you know, was anti-Semitic, but I think that is a fear of mine, you know, knowing what I know about anti-globalization activists, and I myself would consider myself anti-globalization, and Sarah would be proud to know that it's through her influence that I've become more of an anti-capitalist. Knowing Sarah has moved me to the left. But there is a connection between anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism, and so it creates a really unique space when you are a Jew who is against Israel, because who do you align yourself with?
That's absolutely one of the central things I wanted to touch on in this conversation. My good friend Sasha Meinrath, his father's Jewish, his mother's not, he has a Jewish last name. There is a disturbing amount of anti-Semitism within the international indie media movement, which is sort of born by anti-capitalist, anti-globalization struggles, such that when he does something that some people don't like, they throw all of these hideous, you're a Zionist, you know, Jewish pig. I mean, this it is so ridiculous, but you know, it's just this somehow seen okay to do that in a way that saying you faggot wouldn't be okay, and that's
on the circle you're
in that circle. saying you faggot would not be okay. Saying you Zionist pig, that's okay. And so even in a space that's supposed to be safe, and is safe, and for a lot of people who are Jewish, that's somehow acceptable discourse.
Yeah, and I think that is a really important point. And I also think it just brings up the general issue of how do you fight, like Israeli nationalism without embracing, Arab nationalism and Palestine. Like, how do you approach this question in general in a way that, sort of avoids clinging to a nationalism of some sort? And that was a really big issue, and that was something that was definitely talked about in some of the groups that I was involved with. But as far as sort of the idea of anti-Semitism being like sort of inextricably woven, you probably didn't put it that way, but being linked to anti-Zionist movements, that really hasn't been my experience. But I recognize that, I'm kind of young and I haven't been, like, my experience is like 2 years of experience, but still, I think that, I don't know, it was my experience that that these groups just really talked openly about these things, and it was coming from a pretty just plain old political perspective and political direction. And I do think that gets tricky because people who like on my side of the family, when I say I don't support Israel, like, my family accuses me of, like being anti-Semitic and, self-hating, even though I'm only half Jewish. Yeah, I hate half myself. Yeah. Yeah. But, and so I also recognize that as a definite, like, propaganda piece for, criticizing, silencing any criticism of Israel. So.
Easier to say, the current Israeli government is the problem, because that's sort of a big portion of it. That's true. And that insulates you from a charge of that you're trying to undo the state, which many would like to do. I think of Zionism as a species of nationalism, all of which is akin and all of which is problematic. And so just rather than get into the particulars, just say, oppose the government and its policies, and once you get over that hoop, then you can start talking about communities, but one step at a time, and I think tactically it's better to take that approach. Myself, I'm more comfortable.
That probably opens some doors.
Did you want to say something? Well, a couple of things. I mean, the first thing was that I don't even think it's necessary to say that you don't support Israel. I mean, I think what if you want to be more specific, you could say you don't support the policies of the Israeli government, and also emphasize the fact that you support the well-being of all the people in Israel. That's why you use Arabs and Jews, Palestinians and Jews, including the Palestinians in the occupied territories. That's why you don't like the policies. But the whole issue of anti-Semitism, it's really a tough one, and I just, you know, there isn't time here, and I don't have, you know, I mean, it's even hard for me to get a sense of what it really is that's going on in Europe that you're referring to. When you talk about the rise of anti-Semitism, I think what you can document is the rise of anti-Semitic incidents, not necessarily the rise of anti-Semitism in the general population. And I think a more recent study, following up on the study you referred to, is showing that the rise in these incidents is perpetrated not by you know, Muslims or Arabs, but by, you know, a more of a, you know, a white, or, you know, a right-wing white sort of, you know, anti-Jewish mentality. So I just think it's real careful to define what's going on there. Yeah, and each country is different. There is this survey is online, and I've glanced at it, but I just haven't had time to really go through it. But what I've seen of it, it's problematic the way they define anti-Semitism in the first place. It's problematic what they define as an anti-Semitic incident. It's hard to know what the extent of the concern really is, albeit that it's sort of bad tactically, you know, to just, you know, cast, you know, to even to say that one is, you know, well, certainly, you know, the use of epithets, you know, but I just don't, you know, I just am not comfortable with being overly concerned with charges of anti-Semitism. I'm not comfortable with lending credence to charges of anti-Semitism, which to me the whole discourse is clearly motivated by just sort of wanting to change the subject to what's going on, you know, from what's going on in Israel and U.S. support for Israel. It's just a kind of a red herring. So
I think that anti-Semitism in Europe right now is a red herring.
Well, I think it's an interesting situation because I recognize very much so that anti-Semitism is real, but even the definition of the way that the word is used to only apply to Jewish Semites is something that's somewhat peculiar.
Except the history of the word, actually, I mean, in 1886, this man whose name I have forgotten founded the Anti-Semitic Society in Germany. And the rise of I can't think of his name. I have it written in a paper somewhere. And so anti-Semitism is tied very much to the rise of German nationalism in the historical sense of the word in the late 19th century. To me, what's interesting is that the word emerges right around the same time that the movement for Jewish colonization of Palestine is really gaining a lot of momentum.
I wonder sometimes if yeah.
I mean, anti-Semitism is it's anti-Semitismus in German, and it's originally a political organization, very specifically in Germany. It has a very specific historical valence. It has come to mean, obviously, anti-Jewish. But it's interesting. German has different words. You don't have to say antisemitismus in German. You can also say Judenhetze, something to that, which is Jewish. It's hatred of Judaism. Or Jews,
I'm curious about talking more about this question of anti-Semitism because you said under your breath or while David was talking that a lot of the Israeli policies are very bad for the state of Israel, and it seems like a lot of the Israeli policies are also really bad for anti-Semitism. If one defines Israel as being a Jewish state, somehow Judaism also becomes really wound up in Israel, so that criticism of Israel is seen as anti-Semitic, and vice versa.
The problem is that the global Jewry, you know, generally conceived of, is the idea of, I like to think of this, I have this image of like these old guys sitting in a, actually did anybody see the Hebrew Hammer? Oh, it's a fabulous movie. You all have to see it. It's The Hebrew Hammer. It's about a Jewish superhero. And there is this council of... I loved it. I thought it was really fabulous. It was on Comedy Central. It was actually made independently, and it didn't get a distributor, and Comedy Central picked it up. No, it's a spoof on blaxploitation films. It's a it's really brilliant. I highly recommend it. Yes, exactly. And it's in the media. It's been linked to also to this larger movement of Jewish pride, like Hebe, which is a quarterly journal. It's based in
a friend of mine from college writes for that.
Oh, really?
That's Sarah so Marcus. Cool.
And I think I don't know if you watched The Daily Show, but Jonathan Stewart. I'm actually very interested in the issue of Jews in the media and this whole cabal idea. But because Jon Stewart makes a lot of Jewish jokes on The Daily Show, and he's Jewish, and he's a New Yorker. The show is made in New York. People who write for it are New Yorkers. And New York is a very different space than the Midwest. And watching the show in the Midwest as a New Yorker, I wonder how it plays here. And I wonder if people get Yiddish jokes in that show. But it obviously does well, because the show has been around for a long time, and Jon Stewart seems to be a well-respected person in the circles that he moves in. To go back to my original point, which is this you know, group of money-grubbing old Jewish guys who control the world, you know, it's like... But this idea that world Jewry is equated with Israel is a move that is taken both by anti-Semites and by Israel itself. Israel says, we are the protectors of Jews all over the world. You know, if you think about, what was it in the 70s with the plane and the hostages? Yes, thank you. And, Israel goes in where no one else will go to protect Jews. So it's a double-edged sword. You know,
it's really complicated. I mean, it's really complicated. But I just wanted to disagree with David's point earlier, which is that there really is something, I'm not going to say going on in Europe, obviously, that, you know, it's a complex phenomenon. But when you start talking about these old myths, the old czarist things which have come back, you know, I spend a lot of time over there, and I hear stuff from people that you shouldn't hear things from. All kinds of people have ideas that, you know, there are three Jews who own all the media stations in the United States, and that explains our policies and theirs. And I've heard that in places like Pakistan, where you would expect it, and I've heard it in places like the Netherlands and Italy, where you really wouldn't think that would have much purchase. So that's, you know, that's latent. And then, of course, it is stimulated by the policies. I mean, I completely agree that, you know... And the religion support this? Yeah, right. You can't poo-poo it. In other words, it's just being...
In The Nation a couple weeks ago. It's online, and I recommend reading it, because if you want to get angry. And Brian Klug basically asserts that it's okay, that anti-Zionist or anti-Israel rhetoric is not anti-Semitic, because it is critical of the Israeli government and its actions. Because, you know, Alan Dershowitz came out with a book recently, The Case for Israel. He's an interesting case. He makes me so angry. He was on Nightline the other night, and he was talking about, I was so ashamed that this man was Jewish. That's another thing I think that's a Jewish shame.
You need to get beyond being shamed when other people are Jewish.
That's an interesting thing. It's anytime I see someone in the media who is Jewish and who I think is doing something really like that makes me twitch, I'm like, oh my God, he's Jewish. It's usually a he. And they're doing something that reflects badly on Jews. No wonder people hate us. It's this terrible, awful mental cycle. He said this thing. He was talking about justifying torture. This was in a discussion about the awfulness that is going on right now. But he was talking about how the solution is not to give agency to the people, to the soldiers on the ground who are doing committing these horrible acts, but to have someone like the president or the secretary of defense or whoever in charge, and they're the one who makes the call, and you let the responsibility rest with somebody else. And so, but what he wasn't saying was, we were just following orders, which is the defense that Nazis used at Nuremberg, and is not an acceptable defense. And I was so offended that this Jewish man was making a case for following orders and that being okay. And I think the issue of the Holocaust, I mean, you mentioned it as you know, Jewish identity is tied so much to the Holocaust in this country. And I have a lot of friends who say, I'm Jewish because of the Holocaust. And that also offends me. There's got to be something else to your faith and your culture and your identity.
Well, that's a really American thing to say. And America isn't where the Holocaust happened. It's in Europe. And people in Europe have basically gotten over it. I mean, they don't talk about it, like, all the time, like us American Jews do.
I think that brings up a really interesting. I don't think Europe has gotten over it. I mean, there's a.
No, not like the old people who are still alive and were in the Holocaust, but Jews don't identify themselves through the Holocaust in Europe in the same way.
I think the issue goes beyond just Jews, though. I mean, there's a relatively new Holocaust museum in Berlin. I mean, there's a whole academic study of Holocaust memorials in Germany, but also memorializing the Holocaust in general. It's a fascinating topic, the intersections of history and memory and public commemoration and identity and the ways that we reconcile with the past, etc. But actually having spent time in Germany, I was very impressed actually with how open and accepting all the Germans I met were, you know, when they found out that I was Jewish. But I kind of lost track of my train of thought, but you wanted to say.
Yeah, I just want to raise a couple of issues. I mean, they're too complicated to really, you know, go into that deeply. But first of all, I'd just like to point out that anti-Semitism from Arabs or from Muslims, whether in the Middle East or in Europe, is a different species. I mean, it may be taking on certain characteristics rhetorically of classical European racial anti-Semitism, but you have to think about it differently. You have to think about it differently when it's going on among Saudis or Palestinians or whoever, or in Egypt, or in Arabs in Europe, and you are, because it's not coming from the same historical background. It's a response to recent events. It's a response to what Israel does. I mean, Arab anti-Semitism just wouldn't mean anything if it weren't for what Israel does.
That's just wrong. I mean, it's if you look historically, it does predate, in fact, the State of Israel. Certainly. You know about the Mufti in Berlin. There's a direct linkage, in fact, between your
response to the Zionist approach. I mean, so this was not anything in Arab countries.
You're right. But okay, if we accept your premise, David, if we accept your premise and now it's been adopted, maybe there is a difference historically, but why should we think about it differently? Why should we respond differently? I think there's a lot more similarities. I mean, you know, you think it would all disappear if Israel did the right thing and got out of the West Bank and set up a Palestinian state and paid reparations and let the refugees back? You really think it would disappear?
Yeah.
I think there's two issues you're missing, and they're both historical. Look who's talking. The first is that Arabs have always seen Jews as unbelievers, and thus there has always been a discomfort with Jews. I mean, yes, Jews in the Ottoman Empire fared a lot better than they did, say, in Romania and Russia and Poland in the 1880s. True, but at the same time, they were relegated to the same position conceptually and rhetorically as Christians, as unbelievers, and thus, and I mean, would you agree with? Yeah, and I think the other issue is that it's not like Europe, but at the same time, we live in a global age, and we live in a global age in which, you know, information moves quite literally at the speed of light, and so that the anti-Semitism of Europe has melded with the anti-Semitism of Arab countries, and it has become, it may not be monolithic, but they inform one another. So at this, you can't say that there is this pure, quote-unquote authentic notion of Arab anti-Semitism, because at this point it has adopted and is in dialogue with European anti-Semitism.
There was nothing that Jews in Europe could do after a certain point to change European behavior that led to the Holocaust. But there's a lot that Jews could do now to change Israel's and the United States behavior.
I mean, these are
that's leading to Arab.
This
to
is
whatever the threat of Arab violence against Jews.
These are all counterfactual arguments in some ways. We can rely upon the history, and then we can imagine what would happen should Israel start doing, you know, the right thing by the territories. But really, we don't know what that would be. We can hope.
I mean, they should do the right thing because they should do the right thing, regardless of what effect it's going to have on the Saudi press or whatever. You know. But I just find it, I guess, you know, in fact, get back to the point you raised, that if we're going to be anti-nationalists, we have to confront racism and anti-Semitism and nationalism, these things, wherever they exist, you know, not to make apologies for the Saudi press. That's why I find your point very frustrating.
Well, it's a complicated, you know, still, I mean, you get into very complicated things. I mean, Israel is basically an ally of Saudi Arabia. I mean, you know, I mean, we pretend that they're you know, that they're in conflict, but they're actually allies because they're both surrogates of U.S. power. I mean, their interests are basically the same. I mean, Israel always used this line about the Saudi ruling class. There was always this typical Zionist propaganda line about this distinguishing, you know, traditional Islam from radical Islam. I mean, I think it's called kind of fallen apart now since 9/11. But they were always apologizing for the Saudi ruling class and always minimizing whatever the anti-Semitic component of the Saudi ruling class may have been. Because you know something, Michael Eisner. Okay, Michael Eisner is a hell of a lot more comfortable with the Saudi royal family trying to get them to bail out Euro Disney than he is with some poor schmuck Arab Jew, you know, Sephardic Jew living in a poor, you know, development town somewhere in, you know, in northern Israel. Okay, I mean, there are a lot of complicated things going on.
I thought that you brought up a really good point about the dialogue that exists between European anti-Semites and Arab anti-Semites. However, I do agree with your point that it is also a mistake to sort of lump all anti-Semitism together into this sort of like monolithic, you know, group of anti-Semites. I mean, for one, it strengthens anti-Semitism to say this is you and you're, you know, engaged in this binary relationship with, you know, with Jews, and there's one side against the other. Because I do think that doesn't recognize, it doesn't recognize Zionism as colonialism, and it doesn't recognize, you know, it just doesn't recognize that, you know, the differences and recognize that they come from different places.
I think it's, even though I did just write a paper on the colonialism of pre-Zionism, I think it's also very dangerous to only say that Zionism is colonial. I think Zionism and what in my paper I called proto-Zionism, what Zionist historians call the first Aliyah, but I didn't want to use that word because I felt it was a term of approbation. I think I'm really bad without being able to take notes. I think that Zionism was motivated very strongly by a sense of Jewish philanthropy. And I think that the late 19th century was a period, I mean, Eric Hobsbawm calls it the Age of Empire, and, you know, he's not wrong to do so. Colonialism and what we would think of as racist hierarchies were the bread and butter of Western Europe in the late 19th century, so that in a way that, you know, if you were British, which is, you know, my area of specialization, if you were a British Jew and you supported the British Empire, there was no conflict there. There wasn't a lot of anti-imperial rhetoric going on. So I think in some senses, it's dangerous to say Zionism is colonialism. It is. Very beyond the shadow of a doubt, there are colonial elements. But at the same time, it is larger and more complicated than just colonialism. And I also think we have to recognize, and I hope you'll pardon my incredibly academic and pretentious word, Weltanschauung, worldview, of the... I learned it in high school. It makes me happy. I think you have to recognize that the late 19th century Western European Weltanschauung made colonialism perfectly acceptable. So, you know, now we can look back and say, yes, it was wrong. But at the time, it wasn't wrong.
But I think that recognizing Zionism as ideology and Zionism as it actually occurs in the Middle East are two different things. I mean, you know, if you look back at Stalinist, you know, Russia, you know, was that Marxism or was that totalitarianism? I just think that there's a certain to sort of say Zionist ideology and Zionism as it actually plays out in the real world are the same thing.
I'm not actually making that point. What I'm arguing is that Zionist activity, so in a sense we're talking about the difference between discursive and material realities, and the material reality of Zionism in terms of, say, Western European support for Eastern European Jews making their way in Palestine because they couldn't make their way in Eastern Europe, was very much about sending money so that children could eat. There was definitely a colonial element. There was a civilizing mission going on. There was, you know, the same rhetoric was used in terms of discussing Palestine as was used to discuss Canada, which is a white settler colony, you know, in the British Empire. So it definitely was colonizing in the way that we understand colonialism, but it was also a way of supporting their Jewish brethren. I think that even a two-pronged discussion of Jewish philanthropy and European colonialism isn't even enough. I think there were other motivations. So I think that those play themselves out on the ground, which is what you're talking about. And I actually think you're wrong. I think Zionism plays itself out as a philanthropic enterprise as well as a colonial one. And you can say that it was wrong, that the philanthropy should have looked for other solutions. You know, a big discussion in Zionist circles in the late 19th century is why not the U.S.? And there were a lot of proponents who said Palestine is the wrong place to go. If you want to support Eastern European Jews who are being kicked out of their homes by, you know, marauding Cossacks or whoever it was, then, you know, we need to send them to the U.S. They have a much better chance of success in the United States. Or we need to send them to Argentina, or we need to send them to Uganda, or wherever it was. But Palestine was not high on the list for a lot of reasons, one of which was actually the violence of the Arabs who already lived there. So, but then they were, one of the words was inhospitable in the Jewish Chronicle, which is a Jewish newspaper in London in the period I looked at. So I think I'm very concerned with the idea that we take the history of all of this into account, because, you know, Anya Lumba very brilliantly said that we live in a global present that does not account for our colonial past. Globalization is not something new. It's been going on for 500 years. This is part of it. And, you know, Israel isn't something that is just going on now. Everything that is going on now is the result of it's totally the result of European imperialism. The same year that Palestine was partitioned, 1947, is the same year that Britain partitioned the Indian subcontinent into India and Pakistan, also along religious lines. Nobody ever talks about the million people who died in that conflict alongside the violence that occurred in Palestine. But they were both products of the dissolution of the British Empire. Where is the discussion of empire and colonialism in a discussion of the present situation? And I think that's where my investment lies. And I am not someone who marches a lot, although, you know, for GEO I do my bit. But my activism is in the academy. And I think that's a very necessary, you know, we have to know our past in order.
That raises a really interesting question. I'm curious about what sort of history is taught to people in Jewish day schools, in Hebrew school, about Israel, and when does the chronicle start? When does it stop? When does it start again? When does it stop again?
and like how does it play out? When I was growing up, I had lots and lots of friends who went to Hebrew school, and I never learned anything about it. They didn't say a word about it.
I mean, suffice it to say that nobody going to a Jewish day school or going to a synagogue Sunday school is learning that the establishment of the Jewish state was a bad thing.
Right.
And they're probably not learning that... I was in a Reconstruction, but I belonged to one Reconstructionist synagogue for several years. But they vary too. That's what makes them Reconstructionists. But still, I mean, nobody's learning to really question seriously what happened with the Palestinian refugee problem, or the, you know, which of the Arab-Israeli wars Israel might have started, you know, that kind of thing. I mean, I don't think there's any deep critical thinking going on about the whole Zionist enterprise. So,
isn't that just part of a larger? It was really nice to meet you both. Good Shabbos.
Did Ariel get in touch with you about tomorrow?
Yeah. I'm not doing it.
Oh, okay.
Thank you. I think what you're talking about is the same problem of teaching American history the way it is taught in this country. I don't see any of what we've discussed in isolation.
Well, I was kind of coming at it from thinking about what's usually taught in Sunday schools, and I think there's frequently there's a real emphasis on biblical history in Sunday schools, and then sort of some very recent concerns for social justice or, you know, what is happening currently. But there's a good, you know, 1800 years that people don't learn about or talk about at all.
Yeah, well, that really is a pretty, I mean, even learning whatever I learned in the 50s growing up, for what little time I spent in Hebrew school, there really was this big gap between biblical history and then modern Jewish history. And I didn't really know what went on for a couple thousand years there. But just to speak in somewhat general terms, and I wrote about this in the current issue of the Public Eye in this article, I think if anything, I think it's safe to say what Jewish children are learning is to connect the establishment of Israel, both of modern Israel, both to ancient Israel, sort of make that, you know, connection in a more, you know, sort of validate that at a basic emotional level, that this is the reestablishment of our country, and to kind of justify it and, you know, legitimize it in that way. And they're also learning to relate it to the Holocaust, to as a kind of compensation or outcome of the Holocaust.
But historically, it is an outcome of the Holocaust. The global community got together and felt so guilty that they had to do something.
Yeah, but they also didn't want them in their countries so much. You know, they were also like, we really want to do something, we feel really bad, go way over there. So, yeah. Yeah, so it was also, it was a combination of that and sort of saying, well, Arabs don't matter, it was just toss you over there.
That's exactly what I'm talking about in terms of imperial hierarchies of race. So,
well, we're losing people right and left. We should probably stop.
Yeah, well, can I make just one more thing, just for the record, because I want to just respond to your, you know, your insightful and complex historical comments and interests, which I really appreciate and support. And I do think it's really important for those of us who are critical of Israel, for Jews who are critical of Israel, to go back carefully and not look at the history from the present point, and not to sort of think back and then criticize everything that happened in the 1920s and the 1940s and whatever, and to try to go back and really to not go overboard in seeing that in understanding what the Zionist colonial enterprise was. And I think it is important to explain to people that yes, they can understand that certainly it's certainly understandable that after the Holocaust, Jewish people felt that they needed their own state. I mean, that's perfectly understandable. It's not necessarily excusable the way it was done, and it's not excusable the way he was treated ever since. But that, among many other issues, I think it's important to make complicated in a historical way.
I think actually that's what I was saying, in terms of understanding Zionism as more than just colonialism.
Reinforce that. And also, I mean, I think that's a way of critics of Israel opening up discourse with quote-unquote supporters of you know, Israel by just trying to make that history more complicated, if they will be, if they can be open to that. I'm not terribly optimistic about where that goes, but that's certainly a good way of getting started with saying, well, let's really look at this period and let's get rid of our, you know, idealized notion of Zionist, of the Zionist enterprise, and let's get rid of the this, you know, of this notion that there was this huge conspiracy going on. I mean, there are historical turning points, and there were choices that were made that can be criticized, but it wasn't all written, you know. So yeah, I think that's an important.
Yeah, I think that I agree with what you said and what you said. I think you know, historical analysis is really important. It's really important, you know, to look at where Zionism comes from. I think it's also really important to look at Zionism as a very real, you know, social reality right now, being played out in a way that is, you know, just really, really hurting people. And it's really also not working as an ideology. It's pretty much a failed ideology. So, you know, there's a question of, like, at what point do you say, like, okay, you know, it's time, this is something that needs to be changed, you know, right now, like, Israel can't keep doing this. They can't keep occupying territory, and it can't, you know, keep, you know, reinforcing like profoundly undemocratic and racist policies. And so, I almost feel like there's a point where you need to, you know, like step out of history and say like, okay, you know, we have the present right now. Like, this can be the breaking point, and we can change things. So.
Thank you all very much.
You're welcome.